nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
My name is Chip Rutledge. It's my pleasure as Vice President for Research to welcome you to this year's McCoy Distinguished Lecture. The McCoy Award was established in 1964 through a bequest from Dr. Ethel Terry McCoy in memory of her husband, Herbert Newby McCoy. Dr. McCoy received a B.S. in chemistry from Purdue in 1892 and his Ph.D. at the University of Chicago. He had a distinguished career at several universities and was president of Carnotite Reduction Company of Chicago and vice president of Lindsay Light and Chemical Company. To celebrate her husband's lifelong interest in science, Mrs. McCoy requested that this annual award be made to a student or faculty member in the science departments of Purdue, making the greatest contribution of the year to science. Since the first award was conferred in the spring of 1965, it has remained the most prestigious research award given by the university in the area of science. Nominations are invited from all faculty members, and the recipient is selected by representatives of the science faculties and the president of the university. The McCoy Distinguished Lecture Series has been established to honor the Herbert Newby McCoy Award winner and to present the Purdue community the nature of the research and its contribution to the field of science. If there are members of the McCoy family present, would you please stand and be recognized? Any members of the McCoy family present? Previous recipient, good. Thank you. Thank you so very much for coming. And I hope you will greet them at a reception that will be held after the award in the gallery across the way, right outside the lecture hall. Previous recipients of the McCoy Award are listed in the back of the program. Would all previous recipients of the McCoy Award please stand and be recognized? Come on, you can still stand up. That's all right. Thanks. Thank you very much. Today we are honoring Suprayo Datta. He received his Bachelor of Technology degree from the Indian Institute of Technology in Kharagpur, India in 1975, then earned his Ph.D. at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 1979. In 1981, he joined Purdue University, where he is currently the Thomas Duncan Distinguished Professor in the School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. In 1984, he received an NSF Presidential Young Investigator Award and an IEEE Centennial Key to the Future Award. He's received numerous awards over the years. He's a fellow of the IEEE, the American Physical Society, and the Institute of Physics. He has authored several textbooks, including Service Acoustics Wave Devices, Electronic Transport and Mesoscopic Systems, Quantum Transport, Atom to Transistor, and his current research interests are centered in the physics of nanostructures and include spin electronics, molecular electronics, nanoscale device physics, and mesoscopic superconductivity. And I might add that he had one of the first grants in the Burke Nanotech Center that was in Discovery Park. So it's a great privilege and honor that I ask you to help me welcome to the podium Suprayo Datta.
Thank you all for coming, and this is indeed a great honor. And I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about, I guess, my research area, which is quantum transport broadly, and which sounds kind of esoteric. But at its heart, though, the basic question is something you can all easily appreciate. And that is, if you take a piece of conductor, which we call the channel, and make two contacts across it, which you call this source and drain, and put a voltage across it, a current flows. And the question is, what happens to this current? How do you think about this as the length of the channel gets smaller and smaller, you know, down to a few atoms? That's the basic question. And of course, one reason this is a question, of course, of great intellectual interest, but what also makes it a question of great practical importance is that every computer you buy has like billions of field effect transistors in it. And each one of those transistors is essentially the structure like just what I described. It's just that it also has a third terminal, a gate electrode, which allows you to control the current that flows through the channel. So a transistor is basically a resistor whose resistance you can control. And over the years, of course, these transistors have gotten smaller and smaller, so that even commercial transistors at this time have like 500 atoms in length. And so this question of how you describe current flow through such things is a problem of great practical importance too. Well, so what's that got to do with Maxwell's demon? Now, that is a concept that sort of dates back to the 19th century, when people were trying to understand this nature of heat. That is, today, of course, we all understand that, you know, heat is a form of energy. It's this energy of the molecules jiggling around. But in those days, it took a lot of work to come to that conclusion. And one of the reasons was that heat, although it's a form of energy, you cannot quite convert it entirely into work, as you know from the Carnot principle and so on. And it was quickly realized that only time you could convert heat into work was when you actually had two reservoirs at two different temperatures. And if you had all your heat at the same temperature, you could never turn it into work. And Maxwell had come up with this idea to illustrate that this was really a statistical law. And if you could think of a demon, I mean, there's really no negative connotation here, the word demon, that if you could think of a demon who was able to measure the velocities of all the molecules running around in a box and selectively allow few of them to get through this door, you know, the ones that were faster. So if you saw the slow ones, you'd close the door, and if you saw the fast ones, you open the door. Then what would happen is after some time, you'd have all the fast ones on one side and slow ones on the other, which of course would mean that one side would get hotter and the other side would get colder. And that is, of course, what second law says you cannot do. And so over the years, this has inspired a lot of debate. If you do a Google search, you'll turn up literally hundreds of articles discussing what exactly is wrong. Of course, everyone believes there's something wrong because you probably shouldn't be able to do it. So what exactly is wrong, and so on. Now, what's that got to do with nano devices? Well, the devices now have gotten small enough that you can realistically think of building a device that kind of does just this. And that's what I'll try to describe in the second half of my talk, actually, that where you could think of putting something there, and I'll explain what the something is, which allows electrons to get from left to right, but not from right to left, so that just left to itself, current should flow in the circuit, and you could actually extract energy from it. Now, question is, what's wrong, and will it work, how far does it work, et cetera. And this is a very clear, well-defined device that one could build. In fact, there's experimental evidence from some of it also. So we could analyze exactly why the demon really doesn't work and doesn't solve all our energy problems. See? But this is what I'll get to in the second part of my talk. Because first, what I really want to go through a little bit is how one thinks about current flow in small devices. Now, this is where, I guess, many of you may not be familiar with how to think about current flow in devices, but those of you who are probably think about it in a different way. And the reason is that what's common in the literature, what's common the way most of us have grown up with, is what I'd call a top-down view. And this top-down view, although it's served us very well and it's very nice, but it's not very useful when thinking about very small devices, which is why I want to explain later on the bottom-up view, which is what is much more useful when you want to think about small things. Okay. Now, the top-down view works something like this. Somewhere in high school, you learn that this voltage and current that I talked about, they are related by something called resistance. And the inverse of the resistance is this conductance, And Ohm's law says conductance is proportional to the area, the cross-sectional area, inversely proportional to the length. There's something called conductivity. That's what you learn in high school. Somewhere in your undergraduate years, you learn that when electrons go through a device, of course, they perform this random walk. There's all kinds of scattering centers inside the channel, and so they perform this random walk, and you could define something called a mean free time, the time that an electron travels before it gets scattered all over the place. So that time is tau, and so you learn that the conductivity actually is proportional to, this Q is the charge on an electron, but these three quantities, namely the electron density N, the mean free time tau, and the mass M. Now, when you come at this field from that point of view, of course, once you get to small structures, this gets really confusing. Because nowadays, of course, people are able to make measurements, measure the conductance of things as small as a benzene molecule. See? And now when you start thinking about this one in these terms, it's not quite clear what the tau is anymore, because electrons are getting from one end to the other without any scattering. There's no clear, well-defined tau anyway. The mass isn't clear at all, because that mass is not supposed to be the electron mass. It's supposed to be this effective mass, which comes from the band structure of the solid, an infinite periodic solid. And so you don't quite know what to do with that either. And then actually even the N isn't terribly clear, because N is supposed to be not all the electrons in the material. It's supposed to be the free electrons. You know, question is which ones are free, which ones are not, and so on. So the general consensus is that, you know, this is an extremely complicated subject. And the way the top-down view works is you learn this in high school, this in undergraduate, never quite get to this unless you happen to get a PhD. See? Now, by contrast, though, what I feel is the bottom-up view is really much more useful in terms of understanding small things. And the only reason it's not very popular is just historical. It's just that 20 years ago, no one knew what the answer here is. So they didn't quite know the bottom line. And so they preferred to start where they understood it well. But now that we understand this one, it really makes a lot more sense to start the other way, you see? So the way this bottom-up view would work is something like this. You say that, what is the conductance of something really small, like something as small as a hydrogen molecule? And what I'd like to convince you is that the conductance of something really small is this quantity Q square over H. This is a fundamental constant, really, because Q is the charge on an electron and H is Planck's constant. And if you put in those numbers, it comes to the inverse of 25.8 kiloohms. Now, of course, if you made bad contacts to this thing, you could be measuring lower conductances, but this is like the maximum conductance you could get through something really small. And when you get to something a little bigger, then the conductance is given by this conductance quantum times this quantity, the density of states, times something I'll call the escape rate. And what that means is if I put an electron in there, what is the rate at which it escapes into the contacts? So that's this bottom-up view that I want to kind of convey, and this is useful in terms of thinking about nano devices that we are. Okay. Now, of course, the important concept here is this bottom line, that why is the conductance of something really small given by Q square over H? So that's what I'd like to explain next. Now, the way you think about this, I mean, any structure, if you have these two contacts and you have this channel, when you want to think about it, the first step is to draw an energy level diagram. And the idea is that just like a hydrogen atom, any material, of course, has a set of energy levels, some of which are filled with electrons and some of which are empty. And how do you know where these levels are? Well, people have measured these. People can calculate these based on different models. And the way they measure it is the filled levels are measured by photoelectric effect, typically. You hit it with light, see what photon energy it needs to knock an electron out of the solid. The empty ones, you couldn't, of course, measure with the photoelectric effect, but you could do it inverse photoelectric effect, or you could do optical absorption measurements. So that's how people know about these levels. And the contacts, those are large regions, relatively. And so the energy levels are all close together. So you actually have a continuous density of states, and these states are all filled up to some point, which you call the electrochemical potential. Everything below it is filled, everything above it is empty. Now, what determines whether this solid conducts or not? Well, just whether there are states right there or not, right around the electrochemical potential. So if there are no states, like I've drawn it, it won't conduct very well. If there are states, it will conduct. Okay. So how could you make this conduct? Well, if you had a gate on which you could apply a voltage, a positive voltage, then what it would do is it would lower all these energy levels. Whenever you put a positive voltage, you'd make it easier for electrons to get into that region, which means all the energy levels get lowered. And if it's lowered, of course, you can see it will be able to conduct because you have states there. You put a negative voltage, you raise all of those levels, and that again allows it to conduct because right around the chemical potential you have states. So that's the, in fact, that's the essence of how transistors work too. I mean, the gate electrode, I said, controls the resistance. The way it does it is it basically moves the levels up and down. Now, what I'd now like to talk about is, why is it that you need states near the chemical potential in order to conduct? I mean, after all, you got all these electrons down here. Why don't they help? Why is it that you need states right around the chemical potential? Well, the way I think about it is the following, that when you apply a voltage to the drain, like a positive voltage, what you're doing is you are pulling down all the states in the drain. And of course, along with the states, you pull down the electrochemical potential too. Pull this down. And so, when you look at these states, they're in a kind of unusual situation. It's like this. These states here are below the electrochemical potential on the left, which means the left contact would really like to fill them up because they would like to bring it in equilibrium with the left contact. And those states are also above the electrochemical potential on the right, which means this contact would really like to keep it empty and would like to pull those electrons out. And so what happens is this contact keeps putting in electrons and this contact keeps pulling them out. And of course, the battery then fills it up again. And so that's why the current keeps flowing in this circuit. Okay. Now you could have it the other way too, in the sense if you had filled states, that doesn't matter. You could always pull one out first and then fill it up. That's okay. So either way, of course, the point is to have states around the chemical potential. Now, why don't these states help? Well, that's because, you see, they're down here. Both contacts want to fill them up. So they just remain filled. I mean, nothing more happens. No current flows. They just remain filled. Everyone's happy. That's it. You see? But the current flows only when, you see, when you have these states where these two contacts have two different agendas. One wants to fill it up, one wants to empty it. Now, for small things, it really is almost that simple. Whereas in big things, you know, I've often had long arguments about whether it's the electrical potential that really drives things or whether it's the chemical potential, what is drift, what is diffusion, all kinds of issues. But when it comes to small things, it's really as simple as that. Okay. Now, to make this a little more quantitative, I'd like to define this quantity I call escape rate. And the escape rate basically is the following, that if you have an electron in one of these levels here, then what we know is sooner or later it will escape into the contact. So the question is at what rate does it do that? So what is the rate at which it will escape out into the contact? And that will be a number like per second. And what we define is this quantity, gamma over H bar, so which is the rate at which it escapes. So that's per second, which means gamma has the dimensions of energy. Now, I didn't really need to do that at this stage, but I think in a couple of slides you see why I do it. And you could define an escape rate for the right contact and an escape rate for the left contact. And so if you had, for example, a bad contact, like you have some crud in here so electrons can't escape there, well, the corresponding gamma would be small. That's it. So it's a quantity you could measure. You could see how easily electrons escape. That's what gamma is. Now, think of a device that's really small. So it's got just one level. And the question is then, what is the current versus voltage characteristics of a device with just one level? And what you can see is that when you apply a voltage and you pull up this chemical potential, at first no current will flow. Because current flows when this level comes within this window between mu1 and mu2. As long as it's outside the window, no current flows. So at first, no current will flow. And then, at some point, the current will step up. And that's, of course, when this mu2 will cross that level. That's when current will start flowing. And so you expect this current step. And that's what people see often in very small devices. Now, what is the maximum value of this current? Well, what you can argue is that it will be Q times this gamma over H bar. Why? Because Q is this charge on an electron. Gamma over H bar tells you the rate at which electrons come in and out. Now, why did I have to divide by 2? Well, that's because you have got these two contacts to it. So if you have electrons coming in here at 1 per second, and then it takes another second to get out, you kind of take 2 seconds to do the whole thing. So it becomes, so the rate becomes half. And of course, for what I'm doing here, the numerical factors aren't terribly important. I mean, I could easily be missing pi's and things like that. But the point is then that the maximum value of the current is like Q gamma over H bar. Now, the question you could ask is, what is the conductance? Now, conductance, of course, is the slope here. What is the rate at which this current rises? Di dv, that slope. Now, if you look at the slope then, of course, question is, what determines this slope? Now, if you were at zero temperature with the Fermi functions infinitely sharp, you'd expect the step to be abrupt. And in that case, of course, the slope would have been infinite. Now, because of this temperature, what happens is electrons are actually distributed according to a Fermi function. And this green curve probably isn't showing very well. But the point is that it's not like states below mu2 are filled and above mu2 are completely empty. That transition occurs over a range of energy that's on the order of a few kT. And so what you expect then is that the slope, the voltage range over which this transition takes place would be a few kT. And from that point of view, you'd say the conductance has to be Q gamma over H bar divided by kT. Now, that's kind of true, but there's one factor we are missing here, and that's very important, and that is this. You see, what happens is, and this is what quantum mechanics tells us, is that when you connect to this level, when you connect the contact to this level, it broadens out, because now the electrons in this level have a finite lifetime. And the broadening actually is related to the escape rate through this H bar. And that's why I guess I define the rate as gamma over H bar, because gamma is kind of the associated broadening. So the net result is that because this level has broadened now, that also tends to pull out the range over which the transition takes place. And so when you write the conductance, you see something like this, Q gamma over H bar divided by something that depends on the broadening and the temperature. And the thing is, if the temperature is low, then of course you have this, or just the gamma, this rate, and you'll see that cancels out. And so what you get is then a conductance that is kind of independent of how strongly you couple, you see? And you get this Q squared over 4 H bar, and that's the point that I was trying to make, that when something's really small, the conductance you get is this conductance quantum, Q squared over, actually the correct answer if you put in all the pi's correctly would be Q squared over 2 pi H bar, Q squared over H. That's what people measure for something really small. And you'll notice, of course, that a very crucial step in this argument was this broadening, this idea that anytime you couple to a level, you also broaden it, which, you know, you could call it the uncertainty principle, energy time uncertainty. You could give other explanations for it. You could say that the density of states from the surrounding contacts kind of leaked in here a little bit. But whatever it is, the point is that a level, when you couple to it, it broadens out. But there is a sum rule that even after it broadens, it still holds only one electron. That's not an obvious thing. Okay. Anyway, so this is basically the reason why something small, you could say, always has this conductance of Q squared over H. Okay. Now, let me just say a couple of words about something called single electron charging. And the reason is that this is one thing people observe, which is evidence of the particle nature of electrons. Like what I just described to you before could be, you could call the wave nature of electrons, the fact that it comes from Schrodinger equation, the fact that it broadens out. But this one you could call the particle nature, in the sense that what people observe is, instead of what I just showed you, this current stepping up like so, they see these two steps, actually. And the way they understand the two steps is the following, that when you raise the chemical potential on one contact so that this electron has come in. Because this electron has come in, there's this electron-electron interaction. The other level floats up over there. Now, the question you could ask is, well, the other level floats up. What about this level itself? And the point is that electrons don't interact with themselves. There's no self-interaction. And that is the part, of course, where the particle picture comes in, that every electron kind of feels potential due to other electrons, not due to itself. And so because this level is filled, that one floats up. But because that level is empty, this level stays where it is. And that is why you see first one step, and then the next step comes in when you raise the mu far enough. And this is, again, one of the major issues that, again, if you did a Google search, you'll turn up hundreds of papers on self-interaction correction. And this can be important in devices where the single electron charging energy, which means the potential by which this electron level floats due to one electron, when that quantity U0 is much bigger than these other energy parameters of interest like gamma and KT. But this is something I won't talk much about. I just wanted to mention it in this context. Usually, of course, people ignore these things and they go on with, and that works because often gamma and KT are the relevant energy parameters, which are much bigger than the single electron charging energy. Okay. Now, for conductance then, what we'd like to write down is, we say that the conductance of just one level is this Q square over H. What we'd like to write down is a general expression for the conductance, and that you can write down by noting that current per state is this Q gamma over H bar, and you multiply it by the number of states that lie between mu 1 and mu 2, which is the density of states times this Q times V. That's the applied potential by which mu 2 has been lowered. And that then gives you a simple expression for this conductance. It's this Q square over this conductance quantum times this quantity density of states times the escape rate. And this gives you a, what I'd call the bottom-up way of thinking of things. And here, the, of course, the most important parameters are this density of states and the escape rate. Those are the important quantities. You didn't have to go through EK relations. You didn't have to go through band structure and all those things where, you know, because we spend a lot of time, we tell people, you see, we can't even talk about things till you understand EK diagrams. And the fact is, of course, we are talking about things that are 100 atoms long where EK diagrams are somewhat dubious anyway. See? And the point is, what's really fundamental is really the density of states. There's one little thing I'll just to give you, make you comfortable with this way of thinking. Let me just show you that if you go to something big, you do get Ohm's law out of it. And there the idea is that, you see, if you go to something big, then the density of states is proportional to the volume, which is like the cross-sectional area times the length. Now, question is, what about the escape rate? Now, if you think of electrons as going ballistically through a conductor, then you'd say the time it takes for the electrons to escape is equal to the velocity divided by the length. And that way the gamma is 1 over L, so that when you multiply it, the conductance becomes proportional to the area. And that's what is true of ballistic conductors. You see, ballistic conductors have a resistance that is independent of the length. It only depends on the area. You can make it as long as you want. The resistance that you have is really at the interfaces. And in fact, this is the thing that in the beginning caused much confusion because people didn't really understand that. Now, of course, if you went to a diffusive regime, then one could argue that the escape rate is actually goes as 1 over L square, because you can say that when an electron wants to escape from this region, but it cannot just travel ballistically, it's scattered kind of like a drunken person all over the place, the time it takes to get through the thing is inversely proportional to L squared. And in that case, you'd get Ohm's law out of it. But this, of course, is hiding an enormous amount of physics. I mean, this itself could be the story of a complete seminar, like exactly how does one get into this diffusive regime. But what I really want to get on with then is this concept of, see, the idea that in the ballistic regime, the resistance is really at the interfaces. So one question that you could ask is, like when you run a current through a device, there's a power dissipated. Now, question is, where is this power dissipated, this V times I? The idea is, of course, every time an electron gets from left to right, it loses an amount of energy QV. Now, where is this energy dissipated? And the point is, this model that people have nowadays, which is called the Landauer model, the view is that the electron really gets from left to right without losing any energy. That's the picture people had. It goes elastically through the device. Now, when it appears here, of course, it's a hot electron, and it immediately loses all the energies into this contact, and then that's where the dissipation really takes place. And what's left behind here, that's like a hot hole, a hole deep inside the Fermi sea, and that gets filled up, and that is again where the dissipation takes place. So that's the view in this Landauer model, which originally Landauer had proposed as a nice conceptual way of doing this. Because you see, in transport, as I'll try to explain, the real conceptual challenge has always been how to combine this dynamics with dissipation. And Landauer's model had the nice feature that it separated the two out into two spatially distinct regions. So you had a region where it was purely dynamics, and you could use Newton's law or Schrodinger equation. And then there was a region where it was pure dissipation. And there, of course, you take care of it very simply, because you don't really get into the details of how dissipation takes place. You simply legislate that distribution function is always kept at equilibrium. Just by legislating that, you kind of take care of all these very complicated issues. See? And that is the model that Landauer had proposed, which of course purely for conceptual reasons, but nowadays this is particularly relevant to a lot of the devices that are currently in operation. Because, you see, carbon nanotubes, people are running enormous amount of current through it, and people argue that, you know, if all that power were actually being dissipated in the nanotube, it would have burnt up. And the belief is the only reason it doesn't burn up is because most of the heat is really out in the contacts. And that is why, which of course is a big thing and can easily get rid of all that heat. See? And so there's a lot of evidence that this is a picture that's really closer to reality when it comes to really small things. But when it comes to big things, though, of course, it is the dissipation inside that is important. And that is why usually the top-down story gets much more complicated. You see, I said most of us have grown up with the top-down story. And that is, in the top-down story, of course, the contacts are unimportant. In fact, you see, when I was a graduate student, theorists seldom worried about contacts. I mean, experimentalists always did, because they had to make them and actually make it work. But theorists would never even draw contacts. It was just a minor detail someplace, you see? And that has changed completely. I mean, these days, theorists draw contacts, because the contacts are the important thing. And so that is where most of the action is. But in those days, of course, the important thing was here. And so conceptually also, that makes it harder to teach, because you see the theory of this dynamics and dissipation all mixed up is a whole lot more complicated than, you know, having this separated, dynamics and dissipation, you know, in two different places. Now I can get on to this thing about the Maxwell's demon, right? And of course, this also basically illustrates the same principle that I'm trying to talk about this dynamics and dissipation and how to combine it. That's really the main challenge of transport theory. As I said earlier, what I work on is quantum transport. And what I'm trying to give you is kind of the issues that really go into what we do. Now, for this, what I'd like to introduce you to is a device which is called the spin valve. And the basic idea is a very simple one. And this is actually not a Gedanken device, it's a practical device. This actually is used widely to measure magnetic fields. And the way it works is that, you see, you have these two contacts, and these contacts are polarized, that is magnetized in opposite directions. So this is the one points to the right, one points to the left. Now what that means is that when you have electrons inside the channel with spin of, I guess, red spin, then the red spins can easily get in and out from the source, but they cannot get in and out of the drain. And the blue spins, that's the ones pointing the other way, those can easily get in and out of the drain, but they cannot get in and out of the source. Now, what you can show is that if you had a device which has had this anti-parallel combination or this parallel combination, the current levels would be different. And this is the factor that is widely used for making useful devices, actually. But what I want to focus on here, though, is just this anti-parallel. And what I want to point out is if you had a perfect anti-parallel device, there would be no current flowing through the device at all. And, of course, this is hard to do in practice because for this you nearly need perfect contacts, which means you need a red contact which will only let red spins and not allow blue spins to get out at all. And that people are not yet able to do. I mean, there are all kinds of materials people are trying out in this field of spintronics. And they'll probably get there someday, but they're not quite there yet. Now, but if you did have perfect contacts, and of course, here I'm just trying to illustrate a point, so I might as well assume perfect contacts. If you had perfect contacts, then the point I want to make is there should be absolutely no current flowing through this device when I apply a voltage across it. Because, you see, red spins can get in and out from the left, blue spins can get in and out from the right, but then they don't communicate. So it's like separate things. It's almost like two separate channels. You don't have a contact across the whole thing. And that's why there's no current at all. Okay. Now, question is, what if you had some impurities here which allow spins to flip? Now, what I mean by that is that if now you apply a positive voltage on the drain, which corresponds to a negative on the source, so that you inject electrons from the source. So electrons are coming in from here because it has a higher chemical potential. Those red spins can now interact with some of these blue spins that are present. Now, these could be dangling bonds, could be some kind of a paramagnetic impurity in there. And usually, of course, people try very hard to get rid of them. But for what I'm trying to illustrate, I kind of need those. So if these flip off of that, then what happens is the electron flips its spin. From red, it becomes blue. What's left behind up here, that blue becomes a red. And now, of course, this blue can flow out. And so the result is you actually get current in the presence of spin flip. And that is true. As I said, people actually try to get rid of it if they're trying to build a device that, you know, if you're really trying to stop the current. And it would work the other way too, in the sense if you inject from the drain, then a blue spin, it would interact with that, it would flip, and then it would be able to get out. So in a way, you had these two channels that didn't communicate. The spin flip allows them to communicate and allows electrons to flow. Well, now what if all those spins were of the red type? If you had engineered it, so all those impurities were pointing to one direction. They're all in of the red type. Well, now what happens is you have essentially got rid of processes like this. Because when an electron comes in from the source, which is red type, in order to flip a spin, it needs a blue. And all we have is red. So this is completely stopped. But of course, in the other direction, it flows quite well. Because now, you see, the drain injects blues. We got lots of red. It can flip, go through, no problem. See? So the result is you expect then a current voltage characteristics that would look like this, where in one direction of the voltage, no current flows. In the other direction, there should be a lot of current flow. And if you did it the other way, namely, you put in all the blues in there, then you'd get just the reverse. But it would only conduct for a voltage in this direction, but would not conduct for a voltage in this direction, but would conduct in this direction. Okay? Now, that doesn't look too bad. It kind of looks like a rectifier. You say, well, I've seen rectifiers. But the thing is that when you do this calculation at room temperature, this is what you'd see at zero temperature. If you do this at room temperature, what you really get is a curve that looks like this. And you'll notice here that now, at zero voltage, you actually have a current flowing. See? Now, does that make sense? Because what we're saying then is that if you had a device like this, and that's where I'm kind of connecting up to the Maxwell's demon, you see, with all blue spins there, then basically electrons would actually flow in one direction, even without a voltage. You see? And the demon, as you know, as I mentioned earlier, was supposed to kind of open the door whenever he saw a fast-moving molecule. Here what we have is a demon that's this blue with these blue eyes, I guess. And what it does is it looks at all these spins. You've got a half reds and half spin, half blues. And of course, it interacts with the reds, turns them into blue. And once it turns into blue, what happens is the blue flows out of the drain, and the red, of course, comes in from the drain. And that's how a current flows in the external circuit. See? Should work, really. And actually, there's experimental evidence for all this. By the way, one thing is I'm not showing you much of real experimental data. And the reason is that real experiments always have a lot of other issues in, which, unless you are an expert, it's kind of hard to follow. And I realize that, you know, many of you here are not really experts in things like this and would like to keep it that way. And that's why, you see, I'm trying, you know, not showing you real data with all kinds of confusing issues, and instead showing you more idealized examples. But that doesn't mean, you know, experiments are, of course, very important in this field. You know, even this thing I said about conductance quantum, people argued and argued about it till there were some good experiments that settled it. Experiments are really very important, of course. Okay. Now, so the point is that this is how the demon should work. Now, does that mean you can actually solve the energy problem? Well, not really. I mean, it will, of course, stop eventually. Stop because every time the demon does something, you know, actually lets an electron through, it kind of disorders a little bit. And after some time, of course, you wouldn't have all blues here. You'd have half blues and half reds. And by the time you're done, of course, the current will stop. But where did the energy come from? Because after all, you know, if you could easily have a million spins in there. And so you could be letting through a lot of current before it actually stops. You could be getting a lot of energy out of this. And so the question is, where did that energy come from? And if you look at it carefully, you'd see that actually the energy is coming from the contacts, in the sense that electrons actually absorb some amount of energy from one contact, give up some amount of energy to the other contact, and the difference is what actually comes out as useful work. But that is, of course, exactly what the second law was designed to say you cannot do. You cannot just take energy out of your surroundings, energy out of this heat bath, and do useful things with it. That's exactly what you're supposed to, that the second law says you cannot do. But is there a problem here with the second law? The answer is not really, because, you see, the entropy has changed. The entropy here, you know, of course, we are assuming idealized spins which do not interact. So the spins had no energy here. After they're disordered, they still have no interaction energy. It's no energy, really. But the point is, the entropy has changed. This is something I'll say a little more about, that entropy, which is given by K log W, here, there's only entropy is zero. Here, you actually have a non-zero entropy. And what the second law says that you can extract energy from it up to the extent of T delta S. And so there is really no problem with the second law here. I mean, unless you extract more than that. And which, if you did it carefully, you'd see you really don't get any more energy than that. Okay. Now, you could reset the demon, and that, of course, would take energy, in the sense that, you see, once it has been disordered, you could then put a negative voltage here, inject a lot of blue spins from here, and these blue spins then would interact with the demon and turn them back all into blue. And this is a process that would actually take some energy to do. But once you have set it up, of course, it will again be ready to go, and it would work again. So you need no energy, of course, for the demon to work. In the sense, once it's all blue, it can do useful work. Now, this is the thing about the Maxwell's demon that, you know, in the early days caused a lot of confusion. You know, those arguments, why doesn't this idea work? Well, people said, well, it's because demons, you know, in order to make measurements, in order to do the work, they need energy. You cannot make the measurement without energy. Well, not really. You see, this, you can deliver all this energy, and you can be measuring in a way, you know, and letting through spins selectively. There's no problem there at all. The real problem is that as the demon does its work, it gets full of junk information, because every time it lets an electron through, you know, it gets a little bit disordered. It has kind of lost a little, it has kind of picked up some information, but gradually, of course, its head is so full of useless information, it can't do anything anymore, you see? And what really takes energy finally is to reset the thing, is to get rid of all the useful information. And this is the resolution that, I guess, Landauer came up with somewhere in the 60s, that it's really not the measurement that's the problem. It's the getting rid of it. It's the erasing that is the real problem. Of course, nowadays, you know, with all the spam we get, we know that it takes much more energy to get rid of the spam than to get it. But somehow, you see, this wasn't very obvious that, and people originally had argued that it's really this direct process that needed the energy. Now, I guess, yeah, this part let me abbreviate a little bit. What gets a little more interesting is when you, instead of non-interacting spins, if you think of magnets. You see, magnets are materials where spins have a preferred orientation, which is a particularly low energy state, because all the spins interact, and the interaction is such they want to keep them all in the same direction. And so it actually takes energy to flip the spin. And then what happens is, of course, when you use a device like that, what happens is it actually, there is some amount of energy transfer involved. And then the discussion gets a little more interesting, because one can show that in that case you could get some amount of information out of it by some amount of work out of it if the demon was at a different temperature from the surroundings. But what you could show also is that the amount of work you can get would obey the Carnot principle. In other words, as long as there are different temperature, you'd never get any more work than what Carnot principle would allow you to. But this is the aspect that I won't go into. But what I'd like to talk a little more about is that one question that is of great current importance that we are really working on thinking a lot about is, how much energy does it take to switch from one bistable state to another? That is, a magnet, as you know, could either be pointing to the left or to the right. It could be blue or red. And in between things have higher energy, so are kind of kept out of the picture. But how much energy does it take to get from here to there? And here, of course, there's no simple thermodynamic answer. I mean, energies are the same, the entropies are the same. It is path dependent. Now, the reason this question is very important is, from a practical point of view, is that, you see, every one of our transistors, as I mentioned earlier, has like a billion, every one of our computers has like a billion transistors in it. And the biggest problem to putting more transistors in there and making it more powerful is simply this power dissipation. And the reason is, you see, each of these transistors is a switch. And what that switch operates with is this about 10,000 electrons. It takes about 10,000 electrons to operate a switch. And they operate at a supply voltage of 40 kT or so, which is like a volt. And there's good reason why what makes it difficult to lower those numbers. And of course, your processors usually work at a gigahertz. So if you put in those numbers, you'll find that each one of those switches dissipates about a microwatt. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but you see, you got a billion of them. So a billion microwatts, of course, make a kilowatt. Now, which would be a disaster, the reason it's not quite that bad is that what my circuit friends like Professor Roy tell me is that only about 10% of them actually work at a given time, because you don't really switch all of them together. You switch a part of them, this activity coefficient. And so actually, your computer typically nowadays dissipates about 100 watts or so. But the real problem is that because this is already so high, we're so near the limit, the only way you could make it any more powerful is by putting more, I guess, by coming up with ways of making switches that dissipate far less energy. And this is why, I guess, last year, the Semiconductor Industry Association kind of got together with the National Science Foundation and actually launched this Nanoelectronics Research Initiative, which involves a number of experimental groups on the East Coast and the West Coast, and Purdue kind of leads the theoretical effort. And the objective is to explore options for producing low-power switches. And that is why, I guess, we are particularly interested in that question of how much energy it really takes to switch a magnet, you see? And this I just mentioned because, you know, most of what I'm talking about has this academic flavor, and I wanted to kind of mention that there's also very real important practical issues that are related to this. But again, let me again get back to the academic question, which is that, as I mentioned, if you had all blue spins and let it go, it would automatically go to this state and you could get work out of it. If you want to go the other way, it takes energy. And it's not quite obvious why that is so, because you see, after all, as I said, this has no energy, these are all equal energy state, and yet you are much easier to go this way than the other way. And of course, people believe that it's not just nano devices. I mean, that's the way the whole world kind of is going. The energy is constant, but it just started at a low entropy state and is kind of going towards a high entropy state over the years, essentially. But on the device context, question is, what is it? Why is it that it goes this way and not the other way? What gives it this directionality? And this is where, of course, the basic concept is that of entropy. And I guess it's a good time to kind of show Boltzmann, who, you know, on his tombstone, it says S equals K log W. And people believe that that is the central equation almost that relates the microscopic world to the macroscopic world. That is, people knew from thermodynamics about the concept of entropy. And what Boltzmann showed was that it could be related to this microscopic thing called the W, the density of states. And in his time, I'm told he had great difficulty getting people to listen because people didn't really believe in atoms in those days. And actually, he died in September 1906, almost exactly 100 years ago. And it's hard to believe that, you know, 100 years ago, people didn't believe in atoms. And nowadays, of course, as you know, we have the Birk Nanotechnology Center where people manipulate atoms, they take pictures of atoms. It's all, atoms today to us are just as real as anything else, as the macroscopic world. And this is the equation then that is supposed to connect those two worlds, that's one central equation. And the way you understand, of course, why things want to flow in one direction and not the other is just that when you have, say, four spins, and of course, usually you have many more, but if you have just four spins, the point is they can be all blue in just one way. But there are many more ways in which they can be partly blue and partly red. And so when you start something out here, it automatically wants to go into that kind of a state. And that's the driving force. And of course, in real life, entropy is the driving force for lots of things. It's what drives heat from one body to another. It's what causes rubber bands to contract and all kinds of things. All that is driven by entropy. And yet it is this entropy that is kind of hard to include, this entropy-driven processes into a theory of transport, into a microscopic theory. And you can see this very easily. You don't really have to go to anything complicated. Just think of a hydrogen atom. You see a hydrogen atom with just, say, two energy levels. Where do you get the energy levels? You solve Schrodinger equation. That's fine. But everyone knows that if you had an electron in a hydrogen atom, it would always go to the lower state, not the upper state. Now, where did that come from? That doesn't follow from Schrodinger equation. Schrodinger equation says you can put it in an eigenstate, it'll stay there. You put it in two, upper one, it'll stay there, the lower one, it'll stay there. In practice, it's much easier to go down than up. And where does that come from? Well, that's an entropy-driven process, you see? In the sense, the simple argument is that when the system is in this blue state, the reservoir has lower energy because the system has more energy. And if the system has less energy, then the reservoir has more energy. And the thing is, for all normal reservoirs, you have many more states at a higher energy than at a lower energy. It's just entropy again. It's this idea that the lower state is associated with many more states of the reservoir, much higher entropy. And that's what really drives it. But those of us who have tried to include this into a microscopic theory, we realize that how difficult it is, that anything you put into a Schrodinger equation will take you upwards just as much as it takes you downwards. Just getting these entropy-driven factors into it is really a major challenge. And what we have done over the years, I guess, as I said, I work on quantum transport, and what we have done is developed a general unified model, a unified way of looking at all kinds of electronic devices, where, you see, you have a H, that's this Hamiltonian, which describes all the Hamiltonian types forces. That's the potential driven, the Newtonian forces. And then you have these sigmas. You see what my daughter calls the funny looking E's. Those sigmas, those are the self-energy. And what does it describe? It describes the entropy driven forces. You see, if you tried to put them into H, you'd get nowhere because those would take you up and down equally. You need the sigmas to put in this entropy driven forces, you see. And what we have developed is this unified model with which we can understand all kinds of devices. You know, people are using this now to describe nanowires, nanotubes, molecules, and all kinds of other, you know, applications, switches. And the basic idea, though, is that you need to include both the Hamiltonian type of forces and this other type. And although I didn't get into the details of this, what I tried to do was to illustrate the issues to you using a device that was kind of engineered or designed so as to highlight the importance of the entropy-driven forces, so that the entropy-driven forces actually showed up in the external circuit currents. And we talked about what happens when this demon gets hot, how do you include that, and things of that sort. Now, there's one issue still, though, that is really not very clear yet, and that is what I'd like to say a few words about before I conclude. And that has to do with, you see, when you think about how a spin interacts with this and other spin, the way we think is you have got these reds in there which interact with the blue, and then what happens is if they flip, then the red, of course, becomes a blue and it comes out of the drain and leaves a red behind. The other outcome, of course, is that it flips. It does not flip, and the red then comes out of the source back again and leaves the blue as it is. But in this, so the way you think about it is, every time there's a red there, it interacts, and there is some probability it will get out of the source, or there's some probability it will get out of the drain, maybe, you know, 20%, 80%, whatever it is. But in all this discussion, of course, you are leaving out, you're kind of glossing over a little detail, and that has to do with that it really goes through an intermediate process where this red and blue interact to produce a superposition wave function, you see, what people call a correlated or entangled state, you see, where, you see, if you asked at that point, what is the color of the demon, is it blue or red? Well, you don't know. It is blue if the electron in the channel is red. It is red if the electron in the channel is blue. And it's kind of in a mixed up state there. It's not quite one way or the other. And if you analyze it carefully, of course, you'd see that that first step, you know, going from here to there, there's no increase in entropy. The entropy really increased at this stage where we said, you have resolved this through this wave function collapse idea in quantum mechanics, the idea that as soon as you make a measurement, the wave function finally collapses. That's when really the entropy increased. Before that, there was really no increase in entropy. And this is the point that you usually tend to gloss over. Actually, even at a semi-classical level, you know, if when people fault the Boltzmann equation, they say, well, what he's assuming is this Stossel ansatz. You're assuming molecular chaos. You're neglecting the fact that after a scattering event, all the velocities get correlated. And so even at a semi-classical level, that problem is there. At a quantum level, again, I guess you call it entanglement. And nowadays, again, there are lots of experiments that, which are revealing things like this, and which I believe are, will help us kind of clear up some of these issues, which traditionally, you know, we have been taught to sweep under the rug, really. So finally, I guess the final thought I wanted to convey then is that, you see, over the years, as I mentioned, devices have gotten smaller. And so at one time, we used to describe them a diffusion equation. Then people learned to use the Boltzmann equation to include what are called hot electron effects. And what I tried to tell you a little bit today about was what you could call the quantum version of the Boltzmann equation. But the other theme, though, that has emerged as we get to smaller and smaller things is the importance of contacts. This thing that I mentioned that, you see, when I was a student, as I say, theorists didn't draw contacts. And they were gradually forced into realizing the central importance of contacts. Because, you see, in engineering and in applied sciences especially, we are always talking of flows. And flows require contacts, you see, as Feynman put it, that finally it is only because of contacts that you really have a flow. Otherwise, what would happen is electrons would just go from left to right, and after some time it would stop. That flow is because of the contacts. And traditionally, of course, we have been taught to figure out how to sweep it under the rug rather than address it head on. And in the 90s, all the mesoscopic physics experiments kind of forced us to address those questions head on. And now, I guess there are still issues like entanglement, which are kind of swept under the rug. But I guess what is encouraging is now there are new experiments that kind of are showing these effects. And what I believe is that's what will eventually take us to the next level of understanding in transport physics. So I guess with that, I'd like to conclude. And I guess I've just finished 25 years at Purdue. This is like my 26th year. It's been a wonderful experience. And thank you all.
Yeah, that's an aspect.
The actual details of it, of course, that makes a major difference, right? Because, you know, I said that conductance. Oh yes, the question was that don't the details of the channel, you know, like what atoms you have in there, what are the molecules, what are the nuclei, doesn't that make a difference to the actual current voltage characteristic? Now, at the bird's eye view level at which I'm talking, you know, like a mile high view, I'd say that that all enters into this density of states. So for a given molecule, the question you would ask is, right around the chemical potential, what are the states available? So for example, one of the very good examples for this is the carbon nanotube, which is, as you know, it's like a graphite sheet, a sheet of carbon atoms which are rolled up. And a very interesting result there is that if you roll it up in a certain way, you get a metal. If you roll it up in a different way, along a different axis, it doesn't conduct as well. Now, at the level I'm talking, the reason is simply that one of them has a high density of states near the chemical potential, the other one doesn't. To get deeper, of course, what we have to ask is why, when you arrange atoms in this way, the density of states looks that way. But that's a question I didn't get into at all. But like the course I teach on this, we have an undergraduate course. The major part of the course is really about that, about issues like that.
When you talk about single electron charging concept,
I'd say because in the simplest picture, the way you are, I guess the question was about the single electron charging effect, and I said it had to do with the particle nature of electrons. And the question is, why is that? Now, yeah, usually what happens is this particle nature of electrons doesn't really affect steady state currents normally. The way it usually affects things is in the noise measurement. That's where it comes in, the shot noise type of idea, because the electrons come in lumps, and so that gives rise to a certain noise in the current. But if you just looked at the average current, you normally don't see it. But in Coulomb blockade, I think, is about the only example I know where in the steady state current measurement itself, you have some evidence. And the reason I say that this is indicative of the particle nature is, there it is. Now, the point I made there is, the way to understand it is that when an electron comes into this level, this level itself doesn't feel a potential due to that electron, but the other one does. Now, in order to talk about like one electron and other one, you kind of need that particle concept, because if the electronic charge were like infinitesimally small, if it was just like the unit was not q, but like a hundredth of a q, then what would happen is the single electron charging energy that we are talking about, which is the increase in potential due to one electron, that would become correspondingly smaller, and you'd essentially not see it at all. Because the time when you really see this is when, just by putting a single electron in your channel, you can shift this other level by an amount that is comparable to KT and the other energies. And of course, if a single electron had only a hundredth of the charge of what it really has, then, of course, this effect would be nothing worth talking about. You wouldn't see it, usually.
Yeah, so the current and your device also a speaker, or a carrying a speaker. So my question is here, so whether there's a fundamental difference related to time with the signature in your device and normal current.
In this context, though, I don't think so, because the structure I had. In what we are discussing, though, I think there is no basic difference between spin and any other degree of freedom. You know, I use this picture here of like a red channel and a blue channel. If those were two physically different channels, I think everything I'm talking about still works. A lot of the subtleties of spin, of course, come from the fact that you can have all kinds of linear combinations of these two. You know, that it is kind of like the polarization of light, but then polarization of light is a vector. This is a spinner whose components are, you know, cosine theta over 2 and sine theta over 2. So a lot of the subtleties come from things like that. And since I'm not making use of components here at all, I'm just saying, you know, it's just you got two types, the red type and the blue type. They could just as well have been orbitals also for this discussion.
Okay. Thank you. So we're doing bottoms up now. How much longer do you think we'll be teaching EE305?
First, no, no, 305.
Okay. I guess this is a question about how long we'll be teaching ECE305, which is our usual undergraduate device course. And as you might expect, I mean, that's the viewpoint I grew up with. That's the description. That's the top-down description. That's what you usually see everywhere. And I believe, you know, that really still has a real value, of course. It just needs to be complemented with this other viewpoint. And it would be a long while before all relevant devices would belong to the other viewpoint. That, I think, is very far away. You still have to be able to connect. Right now, I'd say the bottom-up view, the real value of it is it gives you a whole new perspective on the on 305.
Okay, thank you very much.